You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everybody. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is December 10th, 2018. Today, we are lucky enough to be joined by Jacques White, the executive director of Long Live the Kings. And we will chat with him about some of the work that they're doing to help protect salmon in the Salish Sea and the work that, of course, affects our endangered southern resident killer whales. But first, I would like to share some news with you all. We are happy to announce to our friends and our supporters that what we're calling the alpha version of PodMatch is now up at podmatch.org. And for those of you who have been following Whale Scout closely, you know that this is a new program that we're developing. And the idea for this came from David Bain, our program advisor, and it came from the idea of connecting as many whale watchers as possible with habitat restoration projects that are local to them. And this is kind of the same model that Whale Scout is taking with our land-based whale watching programs and some of our local followers to get involved with habitat restoration. But we wanted to blow it up and make it bigger to tackle the size and the scope of the problems that our southern resident orcas are facing, which are the decline of salmon from across the entire West Coast in Canada. So PodMatch is kind of like an online dating site where you... if you're out and you see whales and you fall in love, you want to go home and do the right thing, then you can go online, type in your zip code into the search field, and habitat restoration projects local to you will pop up, and you can sign up for those and be rewarded for your efforts. And even if you don't live on the West Coast, you can be connected with organizations that are in salmon-supporting watersheds that are doing that work, and you can donate to support from afar. So go up to podmatch.org, check it out. We're really excited to be launching this. We're already building some partnerships moving forward so that when we launch this, we'll be gathering a huge audience, and that's the goal, is to really harness that energy and put it towards habitat restoration projects. So one of the big partners that we're working with are the boat-based whale watching industry, the Pacific Whale Watch Association, and you know, they share a like idea with us that showing people whales can really inspire them to take action and to help them and to give them some benefits of more salmon. So podmatch.org, and again, that's the alpha version. We are going to be building in the beta version pretty soon, and that will involve a user interface. So stay tuned for that. But take a look around, see what it looks like and how it works for now, and we're going to be adding in a lot of new features moving towards summer. But I know a lot of you have been supporting this work, so check it out and give us your feedback. We just wrapped up last week our last Whale Scout Helping Out event of the year, and it was just a super busy year, and next year we'll be even busier doing even more projects. We did our last two events on the Bear Creek at a private property site, and so if you didn't hear about this last one, it's because it filled up immediately with a group of youth ocean advocates from the Seattle Aquarium. So we hosted their group and a Girl Scout troop, and we're already full, so stay tuned for more Helping Out events that are going to be scheduled in the new year. We will again be working on private property, continuing our work on Bear Creek, and also moving towards Kelsey Creek, a very urban stream that has extremely low numbers of salmon. So we will be working on that, and we'll let you know. And lastly, we are in our final hours of our annual fundraiser, and we always do this right around the holidays because we offer these really unique perks, and they're donated pieces of art and other fun gifts that you might give to a whale lover or ocean lover, salmon lover. So check that out. You can go to our website, whalescout.org, or our Facebook page and be connected to that fundraiser. It ends December 11th at like noon, so time is really, really ticking to claim some of those last perks. And one of the neat perks on there is a $50 perk. And what that does is you buy an hour of our web developer's time to work on Podmatch. So that's a really unique perk. And there's a lot of other ones up there, you know, having an orca scientist visit your group. A little shelf buddy, which is an adorable wooden sort of segmented humpback whale that sits on a shelf and just looks adorable. So go up there and check those out. And thank you so much for your donations. Some upcoming news that you should be looking for this week. Governor Inslee is set to release his budget. And in that budget will be a line item for salmon recovery, literally. We're hoping, of course, for a big number. And thank you to your support for all of you going out and writing letters to the governor and his office asking for full funding for the Recreation and Conservation Office's salmon recovery programs and other great programs like Floodplains by Design. That's really helpful. The next step will be to, of course, go through the legislature. And I think almost every single time it goes through that way, the governor's budget gets eroded a little bit or maintains. I don't think it ever goes up. Someone please correct me if I'm wrong. I would love to be wrong on that. So we then need to shift our focus towards Olympia and making sure that the highest number available can go towards salmon recovery funding. This is money that's going on the ground for habitat restoration projects that we've all been fighting for a really long time that we know will make a difference for the fish, for water quality, and for, of course, our orcas. So stay tuned for that. Also this week, Governor Inslee is going to be releasing his recommendations based off of the Orca Task Force's final report. So we'll have to see what Governor Inslee is deciding to move forward. Even if Inslee decides that certain recommendations he doesn't want to put forward and wants to drop, they could also be put back in Olympia. So, you know, through the legislative process. So stay tuned for that later this week. I've heard all sorts of different timelines for when this is going to be happening. So just, you know, keep an eye on the news for the next couple weeks, and we'll be sure to post on our Facebook page with all the latest. And now I'd like to introduce Jock White from Long Live the Kings. We are back here on the Whale Scout Podcast. We are joined now by Jock White, the Executive Director of Long Live the Kings. And it is just fantastic to have you with us today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us now, you know, there is so much, of course, interest in salmon now also that killer whales are endangered and a lot of focus has been shifted towards the salmon piece. And in my personal view, I think that, you know, there should be, you know, just as much for the fish themselves and the communities that they support. But these orcas have sure put additional focus on them. Can you tell us a little bit more about Long Live the Kings and how you got started and sort of the work that you do right now?
Sure, happy to do that. So Long Live the Kings is a 32-year-old conservation organization focused on recovering wild salmon and steelhead and supporting sustainable fishing in the Pacific Northwest. And we were started by one individual, Jim Youngren, who had a vision for ways to supplement fish populations for both, even back 30 years ago, southern resident killer whales and for fisheries, in ways that wouldn't harm our wild stocks. So sort of think of it as a supplementation without causing direct harm. And he started a Chinook hatchery on Orcas Island, which was away from any natural rivers. This is a very small stream that supports this facility, and started releasing juvenile fish there. And they started to return there. And the fish that we rear there, we rear them in a slightly different way than you would in a more standard hatchery. We use earthen ponds instead of concrete raceways or fiberglass tanks. And the fish that are in the ponds, we feed them, but they also have to find some of their own food and they have to avoid predators. So they have maybe a slightly more natural edge and we would hope a better chance of survival when they get into the marine environment. Anyway, that was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And because of our expertise in working on hatcheries, we also run a fish recovery facility on Hood Canal where we work with Chinook, steelhead, and chum populations trying to recover salmon runs there that are nearly extinct or extirpated. We've become quite expert in different fish rearing methods. And so we got involved with the federal government and the state of Washington and the Northwest Treaty Tribes in an effort to look at how our hatcheries are currently being run, the large-scale hatcheries throughout the region, and think about ways that we could run those that are more consistent with wild fish recovery. So we put together a group of scientists to develop a review group to look at where hatchery practices might be impacting wild fish and reducing chances of recovering wild populations. And this became important, particularly for Chinook in 1999 when they were listed under the Endangered Species Act. So we helped to facilitate that effort and to develop a scientifically based report on how we might be running our hatcheries differently. And when that work wrapped up, helping the state and the federal government and the tribes here in Western Washington and throughout the Northwest, we became aware of another problem, a significant problem with fisheries management and fish recovery, and that was that Chinook, coho, and steelhead that leave our rivers in the Salish Sea from Puget Sound and also from the Strait of Georgia were having really poor marine survival compared to fish runs on the coast or the Columbia River. So coastal BC, coastal Washington, Columbia River runs were having their marine survival seemed to be very tied to ocean conditions, whereas the marine survival in Puget Sound and the Strait of Georgia really tied to some change in the environment that reduced marine survival overall by quite a bit, about 50% for Chinook, starting in about early 1980s, about 75% for coho starting in the late 1980s, and about 90% reduction in marine survival for our native steelhead starting around 1990. And these population, poor survival numbers for these populations have been depressed ever since those times, whereas they tend to go up and down out on the coast. So we were wondering what is going on. And so we partnered with a Canadian organization called the Pacific Salmon Foundation and formed something called the Salish Sea Marine Survival Project. And we are working with about 200 scientists and 60 different organizations on a five-year, $20 million study to figure out why salmon and steelhead aren't doing well in the Salish Sea. And there's a number of different factors that we found, but this is really the big project that we are working on now. In addition to maintaining our fish rearing up at Orcas Island and also our fish recovery efforts in Hood Canal and working to inform salmon recovery and habitat restoration throughout the region as well. So we don't have members, but we have a number of supporters. We tend to be focused on forming partnerships and addressing technical issues and then taking that information and driving it into action to increase the health of our salmon populations, both wild and in hatcheries. And just recently, as a result of our expertise with salmon management and recovery, we were appointed to the governor's Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force and have been providing information on trying to increase salmon, but mostly Chinook populations to support killer whales. So that's not even a nutshell. That's more like a bowl full of our history.
And I have to ask, what was your experience like as a scientist sitting on the Orca Task Force?
Well, I mean, I think that the Orca Task Force was a well-intended effort. There was a lot of discussion and technical input put into thinking about how contaminants and noise and vessel disturbance and food resources for southern resident killer whales affect them. And I don't want to say I went in with biases, but I attended a really fascinating two-day seminar up in British Columbia on their efforts to address problems with the southern resident killer whales, and came away with some pretty clear ideas that While noise and contaminants are modifiers that don't make the whales more healthy, that the lack of food resources was the overriding challenge, and that lack of food resources, Chinook for the salmon, was occurring throughout their range from the coast off of California up into British Columbia. And that was really the thing we need to deal with. And I don't think that anything has come out of the governor's Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force to change my mind about that. I still think that that's the primary factor, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't try to make progress on the other issues, because when the food is limiting, things that make the whale's ability to utilize the limited food resources or access the food resources are critically important too. So I guess I don't find any really deep fundamental flaws with the technical information that went into coming up with the 30-some recommendations in the different work groups. There's some of them that I, as a professional focused on salmon recovery, am more qualified to weigh in on than others. And I had to rely on people with technical expertise in the work groups and on the task force on some of those other issues.
And do you think that the recommendations went far enough? I mean, do you think that if implemented, that this will turn the tide for our orcas? Are there other recommendations that you really hope to see in there?
Oh, boy. If we fully implemented everything that was in that set of recommendations, I think it might be enough to recover the orcas. I think that the things that I would like to see in there that don't really have much to do with the state of Washington or our governor is looking at recovering some other critically important populations that the killer whales rely on. For example, our whales typically would travel all the way to California in the winter and feed on, I'm guessing, spring Chinook from the Klamath and the Sacramento rivers, and those populations are significantly depressed. And so that's a big problem for the whales. Similarly, Chinook populations in the Fraser River is, you know, the second biggest river up north here to the Columbia, and that's a really important source of food for them as well. And, you know, so I guess you're asking me what I would do. I'd leverage action on those places as we're trying to do as much as we can here. And you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, one of the main recommendations was to increase hatchery production, which is something that your group is obviously very involved with. Will your facilities play a role? And a lot of the language and concern had to do with wild fish protection. I mean, how exactly is that being done?
Well, I mean, we currently, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife rescinded their hatchery reform policy pending a review. And I think partly because the hatchery reform policy is maybe perceived as a governor or a limit on the amount of hatchery production that can occur because of the way that describes competition or potential impacts from hatchery fish on wild populations. So I was not enthusiastic, and my organization actually sent a letter to the governor saying we think that we would prefer you do the review of those policies before you rescind the policy to make sure that we aren't taking a step backwards for wild fish recovery. That said, I think that we have problems. I mean, clearly the Marine Survival Project has and the fact that we don't have the kinds of returns of either hatchery or wild fish that we had 40 years ago indicates that there's something different in the environment and that we really need to take that into account as we think about pouring more fish into the environment from hatcheries. For example, if we just dialed hatchery production up by 50% or 100%, given the way the current fish we're putting out there are performing, I'm not sure we could assume that we're going to get 50 or 100% more fish back. This is what we're learning in the Marine Survival Project, for example, at least in the Salish Sea. I can't really say for the Columbia. And so I think we need to be very careful. And one of the things that we're finding for Chinook in particular is that there may be a disconnect between when fish are coming out of the rivers and encountering the marine environment and when the food resources are available. Timing of spring blooms, timing when zooplankton come up, timing when herring are available might now be disconnected from when the Chinook salmon are expecting it to be there or when they're being put out in large numbers from hatcheries to encounter their food resources, and it might be affecting survival. So how long the kings may be involved in this is we may try to work with tribes and the state and the federal government on some pilot projects to say, if we are going to release more fish, can we look at the timing of when we release those fish and sort of where we release those fish in the rivers and in which rivers, and see if we can improve the overall returns, because ultimately what we're after is not more fish out, it's more fish back for southern resident killer whales, and try to build resilience, what I'll call natural resilience, or maybe in this case if it's a hatchery, artificial resilience back into the system so those populations are more successful and that they will be successful and that success will persist over many years for both southern resident killer whales and also anglers and also future generations.
So what might some of those limiting factors be and how would we address them?
Well, so let's just say the simple one is that let's just say that the Northwest is getting hotter and that snow's melting earlier and water temperatures are increasing earlier and something we call stratification. When the wind blows, it mixes the water and nutrients come up, but also phytoplankton, the base of the food chain, gets mixed down. And if the wind stops blowing earlier and the water starts to calm down and the water temperature is warmer, we might see, and it's sunnier, we might see the phytoplankton growing earlier in Puget Sound, and we might see the zooplankton that eat the phytoplankton growing earlier in Puget Sound. And then, so in natural systems, you have salmon emerging from the gravel and going out of the stream all throughout the spring, starting early and then and going into the summer. That's sort of like nature's hedge to make sure that some group of that population is successful depending on when the spring bloom occurs. If the spring bloom's occurring earlier and earlier in our hatcheries, we're still releasing the fish on May 30th or June 5th or whatever, we may be missing it. So the simple comment here is that in the face of climate change, we may have to adjust how we manage the fish. In addition, we've really reduced the diversity of our wild populations by habitat loss, by overfishing some of them, by really outcompeting them with hatchery fish in certain areas. And we may want to look at things like they're doing in the Skokomish River, where they have reintroduced a spring Chinook run to the Skokomish River in order to have more diversity in that river basin and a different timing of when fish go out and come back to, let's say, hedge their bets for when conditions are better or worse. Even if we didn't have climate change, having a more diverse salmon population would be a more stable situation. You may not get really big returns in a good year, but you also won't probably have really bad returns if something is amiss in a particular environment at a particular time. Fisheries managers call that the portfolio effect. And so we want to try to restore that diversity to all of our fish populations to the greatest extent practical. And, an effort to and funding essentially to ramp up hatchery production significantly to help orcas probably ought to include some element of that kind of work. Yes. While we're trying to make sure that we don't go backwards on recovering wild populations and protecting them from hatchery fish, genetic influences and competition, et cetera.
Right. It's really taking a big step back and I guess looking at the huge overall system, the entire ecosystem. It's really an interesting perspective to really step back like that. One factor that has been getting a lot of attention lately are, of course, the pinnipeds, the seals and sea lions, and their impact on fish, and then, of course, on orcas. Many fishermen who are also your supporters have been calling for a cull. Do you think that this would help? Where is Long Live the King's position on this issue?
Well, I pretty much knew you were going to ask me that. And so I can tell you, our position is that from everything we can tell, from the research that's being done in the Marine Survival Project and other research, harbor seals in the Salish Sea are having a significant impact on Chinook, coho, and steelhead populations. And in the increasing order, I think they have the greatest impact on steelhead, and as far as we can tell, the least impact on Chinook, but that impact is significant in the order of 20 to 40% in different places of the juveniles migrating out of Puget Sound or being eaten by harbor seals. The biggest impact of harbor seals appears to be on juvenile salmon migrating out through the Salish Sea, not on adults returning. Killer whales take most of the adult Chinook returning of any marine mammal predator, but the harbor seals get their bite on the way out. Our position is that there are a lot of things that can be done about this issue potentially that don't rely on euthanizing or removing culling animals, and that we should look to those. We should exhaust those methods first. There's sort of a triage that we'd go through. One is transient killer whales in the Salish Sea have increased their presence here and their impact on harbor seals by quite a bit. And getting a real handle on how that's changed, what the trajectory is, what the likely impact that has on harbor seal populations, and predation on juvenile salmon would be really important. It's possible that even without the transient killer whales removing seals, that just their presence here could change their behavior and reduce the impact on juvenile salmon, or not. But we don't know that, and we need to understand that. It's clearly a potential factor that we should take into account. Again, hatchery practices, if we're dumping all of our hatchery fish out in the environment, and we're going to be dumping a whole bunch more out, if we do that all at the same time, we ring a dinner bell or make a big signal for predators to come and get it. And when in the past, you know, natural salmon populations, they'd maybe be a couple of pulses, maybe the predators would get it, but there wouldn't be basically every single salmon going out of a hatchery on June 5th. So you suddenly have millions of juvenile salmon, even though they're small, there's so many of them and so easy to catch when they're in big groups like that, the seals can have a heyday. I think that there are some structures that are at the mouths of rivers or in places where they might facilitate predation. I mean, things like log booms, derelict barges, docks. These may be making it easier for predators to prey on juvenile salmon and steelhead, and we don't really want to help them. There is some indication, particularly with steelhead, but probably also with Chinook and coho, that the presence of forage fish in large numbers in the environment when the juvenile salmon and steelhead are migrating out distracts the seals from preying on the salmonids, and that they eat the things like herring or anchovy instead. So if there are things we can do to restore forage fish populations, that could help. Particularly since juvenile Chinook, when they get a little bit older, start eating herring, that could really be a double positive benefit for juvenile Chinook migrating out, and ultimately our orcas if they come back. Another thing that I don't know if people are talking seriously about this, but large mammal problems in some areas, people have used sterilization as a mechanism. That's not considered more humane, if you will, than lethal control. And then lastly, if all else fails, looking at ways to places and times and amounts that are appropriate to do some seal control, we would consider that. But our organization is, we say that we recognize that this is an issue. The data all indicates that this is an issue. It's a big issue. It's not a minor issue. And clearly, trying to pay attention to it and figure out what to do about it is one of the things that we should try to do. And I just gave you a whole list of things that we could try. I will say this, that our organization is very concerned and upset about the recent spat of lethal measures being taken against, apparently, as far as we can tell, being taken against sea lions in the Elliott Bay area. That is illegal, first of all. And there isn't an indication that on the larger scale that sea lions are having the kind of impact on Chinook that harbor seals are, that killer whales themselves are, or that humans are. That sea lions are way down. They may be inconvenient in certain places in Puget Sound and the Salish Sea because they will take fish off your line and take fish out of a net. But overall, it doesn't seem like they're statistically that important. In the Columbia, it's a whole different story. The right. Sea lions have completely figured out the dam system and are using that to their benefit. But other than the locks, the Ballard locks, we haven't seen that kind of impact on natural or hatchery populations in any kind of significant numbers.
And moving forward, what role will Long Live the Kings have in this whole issue? Are you playing any role in the management decision?
Well, about 20% of the recommendations that came out of the task force were influenced by the work that we've been doing on marine survival and hatchery management. And so we think it's really important to get a handle on the health of the overall ecosystem. So looking at things like zooplankton monitoring as an indicator of the health of the environment and the ability of the environment to support salmon and food for orcas. Looking at things like habitat restoration in estuaries and removing specific barriers to salmon migration, like the Middle Fork Dam in the Nooksack River, doing estuary habitat restoration. We will be going to Washington, D.C. and Olympia and asking our elected officials to support full funding for habitat restoration, clearly a high priority for us. To the extent that we can contribute to looking at hatchery management practices and trying to make sure that our hatcheries are both successful and sustainable as we go forward and think about increasing hatchery production to support southern resident killer whales and fisheries, that will be a big focus for us. And also thinking about how to address the issue of predation, which we see as an ecosystem issue, not just a two-species issue. So we have a lot of interest in helping the governor and our state agencies and tribes as they go forward, and the federal government as we go forward trying to manage these issues. And we look forward to supporting some of these actions in the state legislature.
And finally, I mean, one of the most controversial issues throughout this ORCA task force process was, of course, the Lower Forest Snake River dams. In some of the last couple meetings, you were noticeably quiet on these issues, and perspectives of people who were sitting at the table ranged from, you know, take the dams down now, to, you know, dam removal would be too risky for southern residents in the short term, so shouldn't be done. Where do you land, you know, in that spectrum?
Well, I think that no doubt in the long run, taking the dams down would help. I can't imagine it would hurt orcas in the long run. I don't have enough technical information. I have, in private conversations, expressed concerns that based on things that happened in the Elwha River and also what's in the Corps of Engineers, the current EIS, that sediment, increasing sediment abundance in the river could be a short-term risk. But I think the challenge here is that politically, there is a very unfavorable current federal administration towards doing this, towards breaching the dams. And in fact, the federal agency that's supposed to be representing the fish has not been able to come forward with a solid recommendation to do that. NOAA is saying that the evidence that this would be helpful is equivocal. And the folks that work at the Flow Center and have studied these issues in the Columbia Basin are saying, no, we think this is really going to be a benefit, and on average it could double the returns of spring Chinook at least. So I tend to think that, you know, common sense would tell you that not having those dams there is important. I think the trick is how do you build momentum, and how do you engage the folks in the region who for lack of a better term, like those dams and want those dams, and engage them in a meaningful conversation about what life looks like without them, so that we can move forward. Because, you know, trying to roll the current administration and the current elected officials in that area that support the dams is probably going to fail, and we need to build bridges, not walls, to making progress with that.
And finally,
I mean, those are both infrastructure. We need to get rid of infrastructure wherever we can. You know what I mean?
It was kind of a funny. Just one final question here. You know, for Orca people who are new to salmon issues, what's the one thing you want those people to know?
That salmon represents the heart of the Pacific Northwest. And that orcas are one of the signals that we are not doing a good job of stewarding our salmon, and that ultimately, if we can't maintain healthy salmon populations, even healthy hatchery salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest, it won't just be the orcas that suffer. I mean, we're all going to suffer. Our native peoples are going to suffer. They're going to lose their culture and their tie. The salmon as an indicator of the health of our overall ecosystem are going to be giving us a signal that we're being bad stewards and we need to do something else. If the water isn't good enough for salmon, it's not going to be good enough for us to drink and swim in and catch fish in, and we need to pay attention to that.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the Whale Scout podcast today. Is there anything else you would like to share?
Well, I appreciate your listeners paying attention to these issues, and I really, to any of your listeners who participated in the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force and provided your voice and your support or your criticism about how that was going forward, my hat's off to you, because that is what is going to make this stronger and challenging us to be accurate and honest and come at this with the full amount of integrity that we can is going to make for a better outcome for the whales and a better outcome for salmon and better outcome for people.
Thank you so much. And if you would like more information about Long Live the Kings, you can head over online to lltk.org, longlivethekings.org, and learn more about the great work you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all so much for listening. As always, if you like this podcast, go to iTunes and hit subscribe, and these episodes will be sent directly to your phone. Thank you so much for listening. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Aussi mal coiffé qu'écrasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée.